Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City, and I welcome you. Today, in our commentary segment, we'll be talking with Professor Henry Giroux. He holds the Global Television Network's Chair of English and Cultural Studies at McMaster's University in Ontario. He was also the Waterbury Chair Professor at Penn State University, and he is going to talk about the real underlying causes of growing violence in the United States per the Aurora killings. Also today, and again, I'm going to go greater in depth about coconut oil and its association with Alzheimer's in preventing and reversing Alzheimer's. New information reported by Lisa Garber from Natural Society. An in-depth analysis in the current edition of Scientific American on what our human ancestors ate. We're going to talk about the Paleolithic diets. They've become all the rage, as we know. But they're getting our ancestral diets all wrong. So we'll set the record straight by Rob Dunn on that. Then boosting new memories with wakeful resting. What does that mean? How can we get better memories? Active brains may be the best defense against Alzheimer's. We'll give you the latest on that. What happens when you have too high a diet of salt? That we'll share with you. Also today, I'm going to talk about, in our issues segment, poverty treated as a crime, and then separately, poverty issues are completely missing from our national debate anywhere. And I don't know that I will have time, but if I do, I'm going to deal with environmental issues on making room for Franken apples. Well, we've had Franken fish from the genetic engineering people. Now they're doing something to the apples. I'll talk about that. And also, it's not a mistake, NASA is in absolute disbelief today over the rate of melting ice. If you remember, I talked in the last 2 years about global warming, and you would see it first in Antarctica and also in Greenland. Well, they just found something from satellite photography in Greenland that has just stunned them. And I wanted to speak about this, about what my guest Robert David Steele was going to discuss, but didn't really crystallize, and I'm hopeful today I'll be able to. If not, then I'll do it tomorrow. The open source philosophy of utilizing the intelligence of the collective global brain of humanity to influence how we should be living. As you see, we have a packed show, and I try to always select information, cutting edge, challenging, and nothing is being really dealt with in the way we deal with it on any other show. So it's always fresh. Let's begin. As I'm sure many of you have been encouraged by various groups, and I do not question their motivation, they want you to eat a certain way. They're the raw foodists, the vegans, the macrobiotics, and of course a growing number of people are now looking at what is called the prehistoric diets, or the Paleolithic diets, consisting primarily of meat, eggs, and lots of it, with very little attention to fruits and vegetables, because their arguments were they weren't cultivated, and nuts and seeds occasionally, because those were treats when they would find them. I've had the benefit of conducting over 47 clinical studies in my career, plus hundreds of studies in the laboratory. My background is in anti-aging medicine at the Institute of Applied Biology as a research fellow. There is nothing quite as important as seeing people make changes and then seeing positive results, not only temporary results, but sustained year in and year out. So I've tried to see which diet would impact people in the most powerful way, and it is not the diet that's being advocated now. But because of Rob Dunn and some outstanding work, I believe that they have misinterpreted the Paleolithic diet, and I'll explain why. Right now, one half of all Americans are on a diet. The other half just gave up on their diets and are now on binges. And you've seen that. You've seen the shows where people eat anything. In fact, one of the more popular shows on cable is this guy who runs around the world eating exotic foods, and including the brains out of, you know, animals and the testicles and the intestines. I just saw it last week when someone said, "You got to watch this." And I turned it on, and he was telling how delicious it was to eat the innards of intestines. Well, eating the innards of intestines is eating fecal matter. I don't know how someone could justify that, but anything's justifiable today. And then watching this other guy eat humongous amounts of food, 6-pound sandwiches, generally 6 to 7 pounds or 8 pounds per sitting, far beyond what any human being, no matter what your size, should have in their body. Collectively, there's no question, we are morbidly obese, we're overweight, we're sick, and we're struggling. Our modern choices about what and how much to eat have gone terribly wrong. So the time has come to return to a more sensible way of eating and living. But here's the question. Which is the best way? Is it the Mediterranean diet? Is it a healthy living foods vegan diet that I recommend? Is it a high-protein diet, something like the Atkins diet? Or is it the even more limited diet, the Paleolithic diet? An entire class of self-help books recommends a return to the diets of our ancestors. Paleolithic diets, meaning the caveman diets or primal diets, urge us to eat like the ancients. Now, taken literally, such diets are ridiculous. Keep in mind, the average lifespan of the people at that time was in the teens. Therefore, they were maturing extremely quickly. And a lot of times they died because they were eating rotten meat. If they came across something that was edible and they scavenged it, and if it had bacteria, they were no less susceptible to that bacterial contamination than we would be today. So they starved to death. After all, today you can go to a fridge and you can find food. Or you can buy food and you can eat, and you can eat a lot of it. Back then, so as a result, you had to start the day with that, whatever you had left over from the day before, and there was a great deal of gorging, so they ate a lot of whatever they had, and then they had to go find new food sources. So the question is, the idea that we might take our ancestral diet into consideration when evaluating this. But what exactly did our ancestors eat? And this is where I believe all these people have gotten it wrong. Here's where the trouble starts. Collectively, anthropologists have spent many a career attempting to hone in on the diets of our most recent ancestors. Typically, they focus on the Stone Age, the Paleolithic human ancestors of our earlier pre-human, humanin ancestors. Even if we just consider our Stone Age ancestors, those folks whose stories span the time between the first stone tool and first agriculture, the sides of the debate are polarized. If you listen to one camp, our ancestors got most of their nutrition from gathered fruits and nuts, and successful kills of big mammals may have been more of a treat than an everyday reality. A paper just out suggests that the Neanderthals, our northern country cousins and mates, may have eaten much more plant material than previously suspected. Still, a more macho camp paints a picture of our ancestors as big, bad hunters who supplemented meaty diets with the occasional berry. Others suggest we spent much of our recent past scavenging what the lions left behind. And although Paleolithic diets and diet books tend to be very meaty, reasonable minds disagree as to whether ancient Paleolithic diets actually were high in meat. Fortunately, new research suggests an answer. The resolutions come in part from considering the question of our diets in a broader evolutionary context. When we talk about paleo, we arbitrarily tend to start with one set of ancestors, our most recent ones. I want to eat like Homo erectus, or a Neanderthal, or a Stone Age human. my neighbors testify. But why do we choose these particular ancestors as starting points? They do seem tough and admirable in a really strong kind of 5 o'clock shadow sort of way. But if we want to return to the diet our guts and bodies evolved to develop and deal with, perhaps we should go looking at earlier ancestors. In addition to underlying understanding early humans and other hominids, we need to understand the diet of our ancestors during the time when the main features of our guts, our intestines, and their magical abilities to turn food into life evolved. The closest proxies for such ancestral guts are to be found in the living bodies of monkeys and apes. I should start by explaining what the gut is and does. I use the term loosely. What I really mean is the alimentary canal and all of its digestive processes. This canal is the most important and least lovely one on earth. It takes you from the mouth through the body all the way down to the anus. But while most canals take the shortest course between two points, the one inside takes you the longest. The longer the canal, the more area over which digestion can occur. Food enters the canal through the mouth, where it is chewed and slimed with saliva. That is called bolus. It then hits the stomach, where much of the digestion of protein occurs, and that occurs through the process of hydrolysis, adding heat from the body at 97 degrees and acids and liquid in the stomach, kind of slowly cooks it into a stew. Next, it is on down to the small intestine, where simple sugars are absorbed, and everything worth consuming is absorbed. But if you've eaten broccoli or an artichoke, things are just beginning. It is the large intestine where harder to break down carbohydrates, such as cellulose, the most common plant food on the earth, are torn apart. This system evolves so as to provide us with many calories as possible and also as many of the necessary but hard to produce nutrients. The alimentary canal is, evolutionary speaking, a masterwork. Now, though all guts are sublime, just how they do what they do varies among species, much as do the leaves on trees or the beaks on birds. Now, when considering evolution's great innovations, Darwin dallied among the beaks, but he might just as well focus on the gut or even the simple colon. A beak can pick something up, crush it, big deal. A colon can turn a bit of rotten meat or fruit or leaf into energy and hence life. Science can replicate a beak. It has never been able to duplicate the gut, much less replicating the great variety of colons and guts more generally found in nature. Carnivores, such as lions, have smooth stomachs big enough to hold a good-sized hunk of a small antelope. In them, the muscles of prey are returned to the bits of protein out of which they are made. The stomachs are of some herbivores, on the other hand, are dense with hair-like villi, and moving among them the bacteria that aid in the breakdown of plant cells and walls and their cellulose. The stomach of a cow is a kind of like a giant fermenter in which bacteria produce huge amounts of specific fatty acids the cow can easily use and store. In other species, the stomachs scarcely exist, and fermentation takes place in a greatly enlarged large intestine. Yet for all the vulgar and magnificent elaborations on the theme of tubes to be found inside animals and the guts of humans, our guts are remarkably similar to those of chimpanzees and orangutans. Gorillas are a little different, which are in turn not so very different from those of most monkeys. If you were to sketch and then consider the guts of different monkeys and apes and humans, you would stop before you were finished, unable to remember which ones you had drawn and which ones you had not. There is variation. In the leaf-eating black and white colobus monkeys, the stomach is modified into a giant fermentation flask, as if the colobus were kin to a cow. In leaf-eating howler monkeys, the large intestine has become enlarged to take on a similar role, albeit later on in digestion. But in most species, things are not so complex. An unelaborated stomach breaks down protein, a simple small intestine absorbs sugars, and a large intestine ferments whatever plant material is left over. Our guts do not seem to be specialized humidid guts. They are instead relatively generalized monkey ape guts. The chief morphological distinction between our guts and those of other primates, aside from a slightly enlarged appendix, is that we have less large intestine relative to small intestine than do other species, which might make our guts a little less efficient at digesting plant matter, though it might not. Now, aside from the potential of gas, our guts are strikingly elegant, obviously ordinary. So what do other living primates eat? The diets of nearly all monkeys and apes are composed of principally fruits, nuts, leaves, insects, and sometimes, but rarely, the bird or a lizard that they can catch. They have the capacity of eating sugary fruit, the capacity of eating leaves, and the capacity for eating meat, although that capacity tends to rarely be involved. Yes, there are occasions when chimpanzees sometimes will kill and devour a monkey. But when looked at in general, chimpanzee meat consumption from all sources is less than 3% or less. Even with that modest preference for flesh, chimps are extreme. They eat whatever they're able to eat in a given area. And so what's changed in the chimps in the last 30 million years? Well, they're eating more vegetable, not animal. Plants are what our Apia and even earlier ancestors ate. They were our paleo diets for most of the last 30 million years, which our bodies adapted to. Our guts in particular were evolving. In other words, there is very little evidence that our guts are terribly special, and the job of a generalist primate gut is primarily to eat pieces of plants. We have a special immune system, special brains, special hands, but our guts are ordinary, and for tens of millions of years, those ordinary guts have tended to be filled with fruits, leaves, different nuts and seeds, and occasionally a hummingbird or whatever they could catch. So that is the answer. So the answer to this question that was raised in the Scientific American is Paleolithic diets have become all the rage, but human ancestors were nearly all vegetarian. I repeat, our human ancestors were nearly all vegetarians. And those that did eat meat ate crickets and insects from catching them under rocks or logs. All right? There are people today that eat crickets and insects, but not many. And how many crickets and insects would you have to eat today? So if you're really going to stick with the Paleolithic diet, if you're really going to go the way of our ancestors, if that's hip to you, then you should go out and start looking, get down on all fours and look for cockroaches. You could feast in most New York City apartments. In Florida, they call them palmetto bugs, but they're just big cockroaches and they fly. So do it honestly. Do it right. Start eating cockroaches and spiders, crickets, and insects, so I expect you to get down on all fours and enjoy your diet. So that's the truth of it, and it's as simple as understanding the science of digestion and why that answers the story. I'm Gary Nall, and that was an elongated answer, but I felt one that was necessary. Now, thank you, Lisa Garber from Natural Society, for sharing the latest information on coconut oil. I've been advocating people consume 1 teaspoon to 1 tablespoon of raw organic coconut oil for over 30 years. I certainly do every day. It's also great for your hair. In fact, right now I have some in my hair because it helps condition the scalp. By the way, if you're Italian, you can do the same thing with raw, first-pressed virgin olive oil. At night after you shower and shampoo your hair, massage about 3 tablespoons or teaspoons, depending upon the amount of hair you have, into your scalp and really massage your scalp and leave it in all night. And it'll be a little oily, but that's the whole point. It really helps condition the scalp and the hair. I was given this morning, walking down the street, from a person who I've never met. I get my juice each morning, my organic juice. Guy came up and said, "Gary, you're going to try to help Glenn Campbell." And I said, "What's wrong with him?" He said, "Well, he's got Alzheimer's, and he's on this final tour, and he, you know, is staying on stage as long as he can." And I said, "Okay, well, here's what I'll do." And this is the word that goes out today. If anyone knows Glenn Campbell or how to reach him, explain to him that we have people, including one person I will put him personally in touch with, who had end-stage Alzheimer's worse than what he has, who's today's living a normal life. There's no other case that I'm aware of in the world scientific literature of a reversal to this degree of an end-stage case. And this is in spite of the fact of an accident, infections, almost life-threatening infections. This is after the person was recovering from Alzheimer's. So this person had to fight off infections of an accident and still stay under Alzheimer's protocol, but has done it magnificently so. So is there help? Yes, there is. But it means that Glenn Campbell would have to consent to undergoing an intensive protocol. Also, for those who've asked, would I help Muhammad Ali? Muhammad Ali's top person, his handler, contacted me several years ago. He evidently had heard on a PBS, watched on a PBS station, a gentleman named Thomas, an African-American 70-year-old male, an engineer by training, who had reversed his Parkinson's. True enough, reversed his Parkinson's, filmed it. He was on PBS in a special I did. But I said, Thomas was working on his protocol every single day. He did not cheat. Is Muhammad Ali willing to commit himself 100%? And the answer was no. I said, then I can't help him. So I will only help people if they are going to do something, if they really commit to doing it completely. Otherwise, there's no point to it. And so Glenn Campbell can call our office at 646-926-5422. Be happy to speak with him or a member of his family. So now we get back to coconut oil. Alzheimer's disease and other forms of dementia, that's all it is, affects millions and millions of people, and it costs about $150 billion a year. The pharmaceutical company is clueless. They have no way of helping you. They have drugs, but these drugs are not going to help you. Now there's new research that coconut oil can make a difference. And I'll quote this. It says, here's what it says, quote, "Big Pharma was not on Steve Newport's side when he began experiencing progressive dementia at age 53 and later diagnosed with Alzheimer's. Doctors put Mr. Newport on Alzheimer's drugs like Aricept, a treatment already proven rather ineffective and which often comes with overwhelming side effects. Eventually, Mr. Newport could neither remember how to get water out of the refrigerator nor draw the face of a clock. The pharmaceutical treatments failed miserably. Rather than pursue the fruitless path paved by pharmaceutical companies, his wife, Mary Newport, medical doctor, began researching Alzheimer's itself. She found that ketones provide an alternative energy source for brain cells when they have trouble using glucose, as they do in patients with dementia. The body naturally produces ketones in absence of carbohydrates, but rather than put Mr. Newport on a strict diet, Dr. Newport simply had her husband take 20 grams, that's 4 teaspoons of coconut oil a day. But then Dr. Newport had learned of a promising drug trial for dementia. Humorously, the drug was created using a non-patentable natural source, medium-chain triglycerides derived from coconut or palm, since the synthetic drugs are failing, and this is the drug that Dr. Newport was going for. According to recent research, when the body metabolizes the medium-chain triglyceride oil, it forms ketones that may protect brains and even reverse Alzheimer's. This is true of Parkinson's and Huntington's disease, multiple sclerosis, and ALS, also known as Lou Gehrig disease. And here's what it says, quote, "At this point, he could barely remember how to draw a clock. 2 weeks after adding coconut oil to his diet, his drawing improved. After 37 days, Steve's drawing gained even more clarity. The oil seemed to, quote, lift the fog every morning. He was alert and happy, talkative, making jokes. He was able to concentrate on things he wanted to do around the house and the yard and stay on task. Whereas before coconut oil, he was easily distractible, rarely accomplished anything unless he was directly supervised. Over the course of a year, his dementia reversed itself. He was able to run again. His reading comprehension improved dramatically and memory improved. And an MRI proved his brain atrophy had completely stopped. So that's one person's experience. But it all starts one person at a time. And that's without a comprehensive protocol. That's on a scale of 1 to 100, that's like a 2 compared to what Marie McGovern and the people I work with are on. But it's good news nonetheless. By the way, all the people I recommend are taking 3 tablespoons. That is 15 teaspoons of coconut oil a day, but a lot of other stuff with it. I'm Gary Nall. We have a lot to share. And that concludes our health and nutrition. Tomorrow I'll get back with how bad is junk food for your DNA. In a moment or two, I'm going to go over and give a newsmaker update with Professor Henry Giroux and a commentary that he wrote. But just a few things before then, and then you'll have a chance to call in and share your points of view. First, this is a short statement from John Dos Manis on poverty treated as a crime, and I wanted to share this with you. Debtors' prisons are on the rise in America. Several states are actively outsourcing this new growth industry, including in Ohio, Georgia, Washington, Los Angeles, and Michigan. No problem. Have they got a room for you? More people getting thrown in jail for being too poor to pay their fines, by Ned Reznikoff. Quote, according to a new report, an increasing number of cash-strapped American cities are punishing minor legal infractions with fees as a way of adding a little extra money to their accounts. And because they don't have the resources to adequately fund their courts and prisons, these same cities wind up recruiting for-profit privatized corporations to mete out the punishment. This policy of charging punitive fees, then jailing people for being too poor to pay them, is part of a larger trend that sociologist Barbara Ehrenreich calls the criminalization of poverty. She writes, quote, in defiance of all reason and compassion, the criminalization of poverty has actually intensified as the weakened economy generates ever more poverty, end quote. As joblessness and poverty spike, and the state institutions charged with assisting the needy wither away, the government instead reacts to poverty by authoritarian punitive measures. The analogy would be what the Brennan Center calls poverty penalties, additional late fees, payment plan fees, and interest when individuals are unable to pay their debts all at once, often enriching private debt collectors in the process. As explained on Up with Chris Hayes, the court dates for routine tickets end up being missed for a variety of reasons, such as a change of address. And then a bench warrant is issued. The next time a cop pulls you over for driving that old beat-up car, you may end up before a judge with bail set equal to all of your accumulated fines. What? You still can't pay the fines? Well, then it's debtor's prisons. And then you have to pay for being in jail. Here's a typical real example of what happened in a modern America. Here's what it says by Ethan Broner of the New York Times. 3 years ago, Gina Ray, who is now 31 and unemployed, was fined $179 for speeding. She failed to show up at the court. She says the ticket bore the wrong date, so her license was revoked. When she was next pulled over, she was, of course, driving without a license. By then, her fees added up to $1,500. Unable to pay, she was handed over to a private probation company that jailed her. Then they charged her an additional fee every day she was behind bars for that driving offense. Mrs. Ray has been locked up now for 40 days, and she owes $3,170 to the probation company. So this all started with $179, but now it's up over $3,000 and she's in jail. So this is what's happening. They're arresting people. So imagine now the millions of college students who can't pay their bills, don't have a job, you could be arrested. You could be put in jail. This, to me, is simply foolish. You have someone who can't pay anything because they don't have any money, so then you put them in jail where they can't make any money? Why isn't this stopped by an act of Congress or executive order? Your thoughts on this. 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. And this is from Earl Hutchinson from Op-Ed News. Poverty issue is missing on the presidential campaign trail. And it says that two reports issued on the same day told two appalling realities. One is that poverty, according to the AP survey, is getting worse. We have more people becoming poorer, and more than at any time in the last 50 years. And then the Tax Justice Network found that the super rich are getting richer than they have ever been before, and they're holding $26 trillion in offshore tax havens. Now, the devastating impact of poverty on American economic life, we know, but where are the advocates? President Obama has not mentioned poverty. No one in Congress mentions poverty. No one in the media mentions poverty. And as a result, nothing's done about it. Why? Why can't they mention poverty? Well, because there's no advocates. There's advocates for gay marriage. There's advocates, as there should be, and there's advocates for prison reform, as there should be. But where are the advocates for being poor? There aren't any. So how many people are poor in the United States right now? A little over 100 million. One-third of the American population are poor. Hence, they have no one working on their behalf in positions of power. That then leads to the discriminations, new forms of apartheid, and this is unfortunate and shouldn't be acceptable. I'm Gary Knoll. Those are the issues of the day. I'd like for you to address them. Now we're going to go over to our guest who is standing by, Professor Henry Giroux. He is the Global Television Network Chair of English and Cultural Studies at McMaster University in Ontario. He was previously the Waterbury Chair Professor at Penn State University and Director of the Forum in Education and Cultural Studies. And he is also the author of many books, his most recent being Twilight of the Social, Resurgent Publics in the Age of Disposability. Nice to have you with us today.
Hi, Gary. Thanks for having me on.
I would like to begin by quoting you and your article I read early this morning, if I may. All right?
Sure.
And then we'll come to the issue that I've invited you on, the real underlying causes of growing violence in the United States and how the media, for its own profit, and not because it's sensitive to the needs of the victims or the people, but purely as a profit, is covering the Aurora killings, and I believe from the wrong angle. And so we will talk about that after this. This is from today, and this is from Truth Out, and it's from my guest. Quote, the Colorado shooting is more about more than gun culture. The current reporting about the recent tragic shooting in Aurora, Colorado, is very discouraging. The media response to the alleged murderous rampage by James Holmes largely focuses on the guns he used. The easy response to the alleged murderous rampage and availability of ammunition that he stockpiled, the booby trapping of his apartment, and the ways in which he meticulously prepared for the carnage he allegedly produced. This is a similar script we saw unfold after the massacres at Columbine High School, Virginia Tech, Fort Hood, the supermarket in Tucson, Arizona, and the more recent gang shootings in Chicago. Immediately following such events, there is the expected call for gun control, new legislation to limit the sale of assault rifles, and a justifiable critique of the pernicious policies of the National Rifle Association. One consequence is that the American public is being inundated with figures about gun violence, ranging from the fact that more than 84 people are killed daily with guns to the shocking statistics there are more than 30,000 gun-related deaths annually. To bring home the deadly nature of firearms in America, Juan Cole has noted that Last year, there were 8,775 murders by firearms in the U.S., while in Britain it was 638. These are startling figures, but they do not tell us enough about the cult and spectacle of violence in American society. Another emerging criticism is that President Obama and Mitt Romney have not spoken out about gun control in the aftermath of the Uriah shooting. Gun control matters, but is only one factor in the culture of symbolic and institutional violence that has such a powerful grip on everyday workings of American society. The issue of violence in America goes far beyond the issue of gun control and accountability. When removed from the broader narrative about violence in the United States, it can serve to deflect the most important questions that need to be raised. Violence saturates our culture both domestically and in our approach to foreign policy. Domestically, violence weaves through the culture like a highly charged electric current, burning everything in its path. Popular culture, extending from Hollywood films and sports thuggery to video games, embraces the spectacle of violence as the primary medium of entertainment. Brutal masculine authority and the celebration of violence is embraced, and it becomes pernicious. It becomes the new norm in America. Representations of violence dominate the media and often parade before viewers less as an object of critique than as a for-profit spectacle, just as the language of violence now shapes our political discourse. The registers of violence now shape school zero-tolerance policies. A bulging prison-industrial complex and a growing militarization of local police forces. State violence wages its ghastly influence through a concept of permanent war, targeted assassinations, an assault on civil liberties, and the use of drone technologies that justifies the killings of innocent civilians as collateral damage. Just as body count increase in the United States, so do acts of violent barbarism take place abroad. Increasingly, we are inundated with stories about American soldiers committing horrendous acts of violence against civilians in Afghanistan, with the most recent being the murders committed by the self-named Kill Team and the slaughter of men, women, and children allegedly by Staff Sergeant Robert Bales. The United States has become addicted to war and a war economy, just as we increasingly have become addicted to building prisons and incarcerating minorities marginalized by class and race. And moreover, we become immune to the fact of such violence. Violence in the United States is a commodity mined for profit, a practice that becomes normalized, and a spectacle that extends the limits of the pleasure equation in ways that should be labeled as both pathological and dangerous. We are not just voyeurs to such horrors. We become complicit and reliant on violence as a mediating force that increasingly shapes our daily experiences. The culture of violence makes it increasingly difficult to imagine pleasure in any other terms except through the relentless spectacle of gratuitous violence and cruelty, even as we mourn its tragic effects in everyday life when it emerges in horrifying ways such as the senseless killing in Colorado. Increasingly, institutions are organized for the production of violence, such as schools, prisons, detention centers, and other major economic institutions, rather than promote democratic values, a respect for others, and embrace of social responsibility. They often function largely to humiliate, punish, and demonize any vestige of social responsibility. Our political system is now run by a financial oligarchy that is comparable to what one said was a regime of gangsters. And as was argued, the message we get from the apostles of casino capitalism carries with it another form of social violence. Privatize everything. Abolish help for the weak, the solidarity, the sick and the unemployed. Abolish all aid for everyone except the banks. Don't look after the poor, let the elderly die. Reduce the wages of the poor, but reduce the taxes on the rich. Make everyone work until they are 90. Only teach mathematics to traders, reading to big property owners and history to on-duty ideologues. And the execution of these commands will, in fact, ruin the life of millions of people. It is precisely this culture of cruelty that has spread throughout America that makes the larger public not merely susceptible to violence, but also luxuriates in its alleged pleasures. In conclusion, we are a country gripped in a survival of the fittest ethic, and one consequence is not merely a form of hyper-masculinity and a newfound indulgence in the pleasure of violence, but the toxic emergence of a formulative culture in which matters of ethics, justice, and social responsibility are absent from what it means to create the conditions for citizenry able to hold power accountable, produce citizens capable of caring for others, and offer the conditions for young and old alike to be able to think critically and act compassionately. Justice in the United States has taken a bad hit, and its absence can be measured not only in the vast inequalities that characterize all facets of everyday life, from the workings of the justice system to the limited access of the poor and middle-class people now have to decent health care and schools and social protections, but also in a government that separates economics from social cost while selling its power and resources to the highest bidder. America needs to talk more about how and why violence is so central to its national identity, what it might mean to address this educationally, and tackle the necessity of understanding this collective pathology of violence, and not just through the psychological and isolated personal narratives, but through the wider ideological and structural forces that both produce such violence and are sustained by it. But of course, the American public needs to do more than talk. It needs to organize educators, students, workers, and anyone else interested in democracy in order to create social movements capable of changing the power relations that create the conditions for symbolic and systemic violence in American society. Now, would you address, please, why you see Americans actually becoming a part of the massive spectacle of gratuitous violence every day, and then act shocked and dismayed when one of its own goes too far and kills people, innocent people, and yet does not hold itself accountable for all the violence that occurs in all other levels every single day? The forum is yours.
I mean, I think that there are a couple of things going on. I mean, I think that, as I say in the piece, violence has become so normalized in American culture. It has become so much a part of everyday life that it almost becomes self-evident. You know, it's something that we luxuriate in, as I say in the piece, as a mode of entertainment. And at the same time, we live in a system that has so privatized the notion of violence that when it happens in everyday life, at the most that we can do is simply blame the person who is basically the object of that violence, so that we no longer wage a war on poverty, we wage a war on the poor. We don't invest in youth, we see them as pathological and disturbing. We see endless numbers of people who are increasingly part of what I call, you know, disposable population, failed consumers, or those marginalized by class, race, and ethnicity, who now are sort of written off the list as being part of what we might call the white Christian nation. And I think that, so what I'm saying is that when you look at the way in which violence grips the nation ideologically through various cultural apparatuses, the way in which it gets worked out as policy, turning schools into basically modeling them after prisons, punishing the poor in the way that you talked about earlier, these senseless kinds of punishments that seem to suggest that the poor should be victimized for their own poverty. I think that what we see in the United States are two things that have to be mentioned here, and then I'll stop. We have to recognize that, first of all, we have a system at work. We have an attack on what I called the concept of the social. Any notion that seems to suggest that social responsibility, social interaction of a kind that matters, caring for the other, I mean, those kinds of values in the United States now have been all but pathologized. So the institutions that produce them are under enormous attack by the right, because they see that as simply a form of weakness, and they don't see it as serving the neoliberal capitalist system, its system of casino capitalism, very well. In the absence of those institutions, in the absence of public spheres that promote social responsibility and caring and a concern for the other, you have the rise of the punishment state. And increasingly what we see is a form of punishment creep. as one author has called it, in which the notion of punishment now becomes the model for dealing with a whole range of problems. So instead of dealing with poverty, you punish poor people. Instead of educating students, particularly poor minority students, you punish them. And you put them in a school-to-prison pipeline. For them, increasingly, social behaviors that were once addressed as representing real social problems now become criminalized. You get a parking ticket. You know, you're homeless. That's a criminal act. That's no longer a matter of the state sort of intervening and doing something about. So, with this collapse of the social state and the rise of the punishing state, you have this emergence of a kind of culture of cruelty that in a sense seems to suggest that any form of social responsibility is not only a pathology, but in some cases is actually worthy of entertainment. And I think this force at the present time in the United States is so powerful that it's become very difficult for people to not realize that we live in a country that is reproducing modes of institutional, cultural, and social forms of violence that are not the norm, that really represent a slide into what I call a kind of soft authoritarianism, and have become in many ways incapable of recognizing what the consequences of that are. Remember, we live in a system that separates economic consequences from social cost, that separates economics from ethics. And as a result of that, we're producing new kinds of subjects, narcissistic, self-interested, incapable of dealing with the notion of the public good, uncaring about others. And it's creating a climate, a zeitgeist, in which we see not only the pathologies of what happened at Aurora and in other places, the mad gunman, but we're also seeing an entire culture that basically supports this kind of violence in very diverse and complex ways. This is an act of what I would call, Gary, it's an act of failed sociality. We live in a system that's failed itself. It's failed its social responsibilities, thrown its social contract out the window.
I just have one more question, but a short comment before that question. I'm concerned that if we tie the two ends of your argument together, that we're becoming more violent, and we want penalties for those who are violent, but we turn around and continue to support violence in other ways as if they're disassociated. The ultra-fighting programs, the violence in sports, the Saints football team, the thuggery, and then on the other end of that, we want to see people, because of our constant exposure to violence, we want to see them suffer.
You know, I think it's a very smart comment because it touches on a couple of what seems to be contradictions. I mean, at one level, I mean, when we see egregious acts of violence that can't be acceptable, that are acceptable in no society, we respond with horror. But at the same time, the formative culture that makes that violence possible is completely operates as a completely unchecked, uncritical object of inquiry. So nobody talks about the formative culture that might produce people to assume those kinds of violent subjectivities. Nobody wants to talk about that. Secondly, when we talk about people being in some way apprehended and made responsible for violence, we have an often misconception of what violence is. Nobody is talking about the kind of violence that is being produced by casino capitalism that creates huge amounts of suffering. I mean, millions of people losing their homes, a million children homeless in the United States, and as you mentioned, millions of people living now in poverty. Banks, as we all know, the recent Barclay LIBOR scandal involving trillions of dollars of people getting screwed, students, suffering under enormous debt. This is a debt question. It's not simply about tuition. When we talk about that kind of violence, when we talk about institutionalized violence wielded by the rich, wielded by those who have power, all of a sudden we don't think of it as violence. We think of it as simply as part of the system, that this is what the system does. Our analysis slips into a kind of cynicism that stops at the level of everyday life, in which the only violence that we can really condemn is either the violence of the ultra spectacle or a kind of violence that basically we see coming from those populations that are considered disposable. We blame them for the situations in which we find ourselves. So we have a very bad misconception of not only violence, we have a terrible misconception of what the forces are that produce it.
I would absolutely agree. You answered my second question with that statement just now. Thank you very much for coming on, and thank you for your editorial. We very much appreciate it. I look forward to another discussion.
Okay, Gary, thanks for having me on.
Professor Henry Giroux, author of Twilight of the Social. I'm Gary Knoll. Our lines are packed, lit. I intend to take as many calls as I can. I will hold on to some of the other issues until our next program. Again, I have more on my plate here than what I can get to, but we're going to take a brief break and come back. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you. I will be taking calls now at 888-874-4888, 888-874-4888 on any of the issues that you hear discussed on this program. Each week, for about 3 minutes, that's it, the model works, so we don't change it. None of the 24/7 programs ever have to raise any funds. Hence, unlike NPR or Pacifica or BAI, we are able to pay our bills and provide some of the finest minds in the world on progressive themes each day. And I'm the only one responsible for raising a little money here. And we create a product. All the money, 100% of the money, goes to the station. And we select something we think that people would really enjoy. Today, I haven't done this special in 2 years. And they said, offer the Ultimate Lifetime Diet Shake. Now, the Ultimate Lifetime Diet Shake, you're going to save $50 today, and it's one of the most tasty and delicious things you've ever had. It was meant to give you quality nutrients without high calories, and quality proteins, and ease of digestion. And so you're getting the proprietary blend, you're getting some green algae and wheatgrass powder and barley green powders and alfalfa leaf and oak grass and broccoli, parsley, kale, aloe vera. You're getting cranberries, strawberries, apples, cherries, red raspberries, peaches, pears, papaya, mangoes, watermelon, red currants, nectarines, pink grapefruit, blood oranges, pomegranate, pineapples, lemons, limes, tangerines, apricot. You're getting an herbal combination of black cohosh, blessed thistle, chaste tree berry, cramp bark, vilex, agnus, castus, Damiana leaf, Dong Quai, false unicorn root, Pho Thai, ginger root, Gota Cola, hawthorn berry, passion flora, peppermint, saw palmetto, Siberian ginseng, ginkgo biloba, phosphatidylserine, lycopene, grapeseed extract, royal jelly, non-dairy acidophilus, bifidus, bee pollen, acetyl L-carnitine, lecithin, and it's got a wonderful orange cinnamon flavor and also a cherry vanilla flavor. And that product, I don't know why I haven't mentioned it in 2 years, but I haven't, is called the Ultimate Lifetime Diet Shake. Wow. And you get it with a $50. You're getting buying one, getting one free. All right? Call this number. Here's the number you call. 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. 877-627-5065. 5065. I'm Gary Knoll. Let's go over and say hello. Let's see who we have up here. Let's say hello to Tom from New York. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Gary.
Hi.
Hi. I saw your documentary on the heart, but it didn't talk about atrial fibrillation. And I have atrial fibrillation. Of course, they want to put me on all these drugs, which I don't want to do. Do you have any recommendation for that?
Okay, I have two documentaries. You have to look at the newest one. It's 3.5 hours long, and the approach is all heart conditions. It wouldn't matter whether it was congestive heart failure, tachycardia, arrhythmias, high blood pressure, heart attack, or stroke, because the protocols are the same for all. And we state that. I state that in all the experts in there, the holistic cardiologists like Dr. Vanini state that. So go back and watch that one. Now, if you watch the earlier one that's about 8 years old, that doesn't refer to that. But in the new one, you'll see all the protocols, and they're right on the screen. Okay? Let's say hello to Natalia from Los Angeles. Hi, Natalia. You're on.
Hi, Gary. I'm very glad to be speaking about social responsibility. There's a huge group of people working towards social responsibility to get sustainability on everybody's agenda, every single organization. It's called the ISO 2600, and it's really important because it took 3 years, 4 years to write down. I was part of the task force to draft this guidelines. Everybody would look at this because
how about doing the following? Would you email me that so I can look at it and then post it up on our website, which is read by a gazillion people every day? So I'm happy to look at it, happy to post it, especially something that addresses social issues and gives us a call to action how we can find solutions. Thank you, Natalia. Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. I have something here that is right in sync with what your guest was talking about. There's an article here that says that federal agents raid Mormon food storage facility and demand list of customers storing emergency food. So in other words, this is what we've devolved to, this authoritarian system where people will actually be raided because they're storing food.
That is correct. That's a real story. We looked into it, and I'll be doing a more in-depth discussion with the people who are the victims of that raid on an upcoming program.
Amazing. And here's an email from a woman who said that her husband, who's an economist, listens to you daily. And she says, we have interesting conversations over dinner because of the information that we hear that no other program on the radio or the Internet provides for them. Her husband is deeply concerned about the Fed giving another quantitative easing in the next week or two. They want to know, what do you believe this would do, and how would you do things differently?
We've had three quantitative easings that are official and one that was not. The one that was not was the largest, $16 trillion and 22,000 transactions, and not a penny of that went to the small businesses of America, to homeowners, or to people in need. It went to the major banks, the largest banks, to give another $1-3 trillion to the very same banks so they can continue buying up competition, speculating, lending that money out, creating greater debt empires is insane. Also, I've said it and I'll say it again, if everyone on Wall Street went broke and all the banks had to be deconstructed, it would not impact in a negative way the rest of it. It would actually impact us in a positive way because we're part of the real economy. They're part of a make money off money. Now, how did we get here? And what should we understand? First, go back in history. From the mid-1800s, 19th century, to the middle of the 20th century, up to around the 1970s, we simply had more work that had to be done during the Industrial Revolution than there were people to do it. As a result, those who came to work could work for the rest of their life, and they made good money. There were the advent of the unions and proper representation and collective bargaining. And that really culminated by about 1970, where if you worked in a place, you could expect to work the rest of your life. You would be able to have enough money to have about a 12-15% savings, have your retirement, and you would be living in a fairly stable environment. Then four things happen that have changed everything. One, the computer generation. Computers made much of the work we had done before obsolete. If you had 1,000 people working, sorting things before, and one computer could do that work, then suddenly you had no need for 1,000 people. Secondly, starting in about 1970, millions upon millions of women who historically had been homemakers decided they no longer, and rightly so, they no longer would be limited in their lives, in their careers. And it was the largest group of people, women, ever to graduate from college and go into the workforce. That suddenly meant that there was more labor than there was a need for. So there was a great deal of competition. At the same time, companies found that, why should I now pay for a high wage and all these security measures and seniority and sick leave to a person working here when emerging markets, and at that time the emerging markets to work in were in South and Central America, in Mexico and in Haiti, etc. But then China began to emerge, India and Brazil all began to emerge with a new educated middle class. They put their emphasis on graduating people who had very high, good technical skills. Together, it represented about 700 million people. So now, in a period of 10 years, from the mid-1970s till about 1990, you had more people who were skilled to do something than you had work for them to do. So, A, in their own countries, they though they were way ahead of the poor, they were still struggling. In the United States, it was cheaper to offshore jobs to other countries. And now, with it even being more competitive and more countries willing to create indentured slavery and have people make your blouse or trousers or washing machine or bike at dirt cheap labor, then you can't compete in the United States. You can thank the World Trade Organization for that. So now you have supply and demand. You have more supply of workers than you have demand. Hence, the market dictates low wages, poor working conditions. Then you have the newest threat is that the emerging markets, especially India and South Korea and Taiwan, have a very large number of PhDs, advanced degreed individuals, and all the previously protected jobs in the United States. Hence, if you work for 20 years, you're making $150,000 a year, you had a PhD or a master's degree, you were protected. Not today. 8 million of the legal immigrants on visas come to the United States and are taking the jobs that had been secure, and now you're seeing for the first time people who never thought they would be unemployed, never thought they would end up losing all their money or their home. By the millions, they're losing everything. And they can't cope easily because psychologically, we've not prepared them to downsize, to get off the grid. And I've been filming a lot of these people. And then you have to look at the mindset today. It's all about profit, not about people. Now, none of this is going to change. We're not bringing your jobs back. We're not going to increase the wages. We're not going to increase the quality of life for anyone. And we're going to have even more millions of people who, with advanced degrees, taking the work of those who thought they would be secure. So the bad news is it's only going to get a lot worse. Quantitative easing is not going to help any of that at all. What would help, and here's simple math, if you paid people working wage to work on infrastructure, start new businesses, and as long as those businesses were local and supported people with a living wage also, if you put 5 million people to work at $50,000, that's $250 billion. If you put 15 million people to work at $50,000 each, you've just ended unemployment, and you've given back communities a chance to revive themselves and save homes, save lives, and have a quality of life. That is the only quantitative easing that you should have. That quantitative easing I just gave you is under any of the quantitative easings we've given thus far and got nothing for. That could reverse infrastructural damage, rebuild America at every community. But we won't do that because the people who want the money will get the money. And the American public will watch this as if they have no say-so in it. They do have a say-so. We're out of time, Luann. In fact, we've gone over time. Sorry about that. I want to thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day, everyone.